Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource.org. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
Ah, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're wonderful. I'm sure if you've heard of the saxophone, you've heard of Johnny Hodges. Johnny.
Out of another age in high pop culture, we are rediscovering songs without words this hour. From an expressionless man till the moment he picked up his horn. From the 1920s into 1970, 4 decades, Johnny Hodges was the standby solo star in Duke Ellington's jazz orchestra. Other band leaders said Duke could afford not to feature a boy singer or a girl singer, as they were known then, because he had Hodges in his band. Johnny Hodges' voice came in 3 registers, blues, ballads, and, a rarity in jazz, the art song. Hodges could swing an orchestral blues sound right here in a tune Hodges composed called Things Ain't What They Used to Be. It's pure Hodges, no matter that he lost the title to his tune in a card game with Duke Ellington's son, Mercer. The great Dizzy Gillespie, also John Coltrane, put Hodges at the top of the list of essential blues players. He could moan a while, Dizzy said, though Things Ain't could also be played up-tempo and fun-loving. A second Hodges specialty was his way with pop songs like On the Sunny Side of the Street, a song that talked back to the Great Depression of the 1930s. With the art songs that Billy Strayhorn composed and Johnny Hodges delivered.
Johnny Hodges.
Musically and emotionally refined pieces like Star-Crossed Lovers, which Duke Ellington presented in his Shakespeare suite as the band's swooning impression of Romeo and Juliet. Not for nothing was Hodges' instrument called the saxophone. That sound of Johnny Hodges is the thread, the plot of this radio hour, about an almost forgotten grandmaster of American music whose biography has finally been written, Rabbit's Blues, from the Oxford University Press, by a Boston lawyer and my fellow Hodges cultist, Con Chapman, is an overdue account of an artist who barely spoke but stirred hearts his own way, not so unlike Charlie Chaplin or the other silent movie star, Buster Keaton, known as the Great Stone Face, which described Hodges as well. What Johnny Hodges did was liberate and lift Adolf Sax's mid-range horn out of the marching band into the far upper reaches of solo expression. And he played it with a tone so beautiful, Duke Ellington said, it sometimes brought tears to the eyes. On Hodges' death 50 years ago, Duke said, my band will never sound the same. Hodges was the almost erotic pulse under the many Ellington effects. Jazz impresario George Ween of the Great Newport and other festivals said to me once, when Johnny Hodges stood up to solo, you wanted to be dancing with your dream girl in your arms. I got a chill, you know, said Ween, who had booked everybody in jazz. The only comparable effect in George Ween's memory came from Yasha Heifetz, the god among violinists. The feeling, Ween said, was of being, how can I say, totally transported. Con Chapman's first Hodges record was a blues collection in a small band with Duke Ellington playing the Wabash blues that everybody grew up with.
And he takes this, and as you can hear in the opening bars, he just blows it apart.
What's your favorite Hodges? Tell us why.
Just that opening bar. I mean, as you know the band members, you pick out your favorite. So I like this guy, Johnny Hodges. I'm going to buy another record by him. So I bought the Things Ain't What They Used to Be, old RCA Victor, and then I bought this one because I picked it up and it said Blues Summit. And I thought, I've been listening to this guy all these years, and he's a blues musician? I didn't realize that. But those opening bars, I mean, it's just electrifying.
Between Con Chapman and me, part of the question is why two white guys of the Elvis generation got hooked as teenagers instead on Johnny Hodges and the Ellington Band. I connect Hodges somehow with my father, a man who was all warm heart and humor behind a mask-like face that had been stiffened by a severe case of Parkinson's disease. Was I predisposed to fall for Hodges? Hodges had his own musical father-son drama with giant stars that came after him, notably Charlie Parker and John Coltrane.
Benny Golson, when he first met John Coltrane, somebody said, come downstairs, I want you to hear this guy. He sounds just like Johnny Hodges. And he went downstairs and he heard Coltrane and goes, yeah, he sounds just like Johnny Hodges.
John Coltrane was fighting a heroin habit in the early 1950s at the time he was apprenticing with Hodges' own band. Straightened out later and transcendent on his own, Coltrane used to say that Hodges still kills me. Charlie Parker's connection with Hodges was musically more intimate. Johnny Hodges had been the number one alto in jazz for more than a decade before Byrd began transforming the sound of their instrument and all of post-war American music. You can almost hear and feel the transition in a recording Hodges and Parker made together in 1952. The tune was Funky Blues out of Hodges' head, and then young Byrd took off with it. Here is the handoff. And here comes Charlie Parker. I hear in that transition, Parker saying, thank you, Dad, I'm on my own. I'm going to do things you never did, but thank you.
Right. He certainly extends the mood that Johnny has set. If you look at the pictures from that session, and first of all, you got Benny Carter, Johnny Hodges, and Charlie Parker, the three premier altos of their generation. They're all looking fairly well-fed and satisfied. On the other hand, they're all looking out, they're giving each other the side eye, because, for them, it's a cutting contest. They're going to see who's going to create the best solo, as, you know, that was the culture back then. And the look on Johnny Hodges' face and the look on Benny Carter's face across the room at each other, you know, they very much admired each other, but they were very much rivals. They would spar a little bit, even though they had tremendous respect for each other.
Charlie Parker had the nerve to say he's the Lily Pons of the alto.
Right.
And people wondered, Lily Pons, famous coloratura.
Uh-huh. Well, Parker, actually, when he called you Lily Pons, he could mean it either as a compliment or as an insult. He was having a conversation with Miles Davis one time, and he said, okay, Lily Pons, when Miles was being a bit too fastidious. But when he said it to about Johnny in one of those Leonard Feather blindfold tests, and Charlie Parker gave Johnny Hodges 5 stars, and the only other musician he gave it to was Igor Stravinsky.
Wow.
So,
and
you know,
Parker knew Stravinsky.
Right. So there were two schools of thought about Johnny's singing. One was he was the blues singer. He was the extension of Bessie Smith. He sang the blues on his instrument so that they didn't have ever have a real blues singer in the band. Even Al Hibbler. He's not really a blues singer. On the other hand, he sang very romantically. And so it's interesting. The three leading pop singers of the time, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett, all said the same thing about Johnny. It's like, he's the best singer in the business.
Frank Sinatra's tribute was to give Johnny Hodges the longest and surely the most heartrending instrumental solo ever on a Sinatra recording. The song was a Victor Herbert standard called Indian Summer. It got into the only album that Sinatra and Duke Ellington recorded together. And the high point, for sure, was Johnny Hodges' climactic eruption in it. Sinatra usually kept his cool with fellow professionals, but in the playback of Indian Summer, his musical biographer Will Friedwald wrote that Sinatra was overwhelmed. He said, "My God, that was unbelievable, John." Hodges, as usual, said nothing. Coming up, Black Boston in the 19-teens and 20s, where the Hodges sound was hatched. This is Open Source. Johnny Hodges' first 20 years were a Boston story. Dizzy Gillespie made almost a joke of it. In effect, imagine a great blues player from pale and frosty Boston, not New Orleans or Kansas City or Chicago. Hodges' parents were Virginians, part of the great black migration north from Jim Crow in the 1890s, probably. First stop was Cambridgeport, where Johnny was born in 1907. His growing up happened in Boston's aspiring and amazingly mixed South End. 35 ethnic identities by one count, a neighborhood of red brick row houses for service workers, cooks, janitors, porters like Johnny's father, cleaners like Johnny's mother, and a lot of lawyers, preachers, social workers, and musicians on the way up.
He realized that he was living next to the Robert Gould Shaw neighborhood house.
Standing outside the Hodges' house at 32 Hammond Street in the South End, I'm asking the longtime State House representative and village historian Byron Rushing what you can tell from the outside about the people who lived inside 100 years ago. The family had a parlor piano, and mother, sister, and Johnny all played it well. Johnny well enough to make nice money in his teens as a rent party pianist.
The piano is
piano
that any family would be struggling to make sure that if their kids had talent, that they would support that talent. But here, what was happening is this whole neighborhood was really built for poor and working class Yankees. Really? We forget that there was such a thing as poor Yankees, right? In those days, they were called swamp Yankees, poor people from England and Wales. And then as they are moving out, you get the Irish, you get Italians, and you get black people into this neighborhood. And you get poor working class Jews.
Wow.
into this neighborhood. And so when I say that he came here early in the 20s, you would have seen everybody here.
Boston's South End was where Johnny Hodges learned his instrument. He had his alto sound down by his late teens. It was where he bonded with his pal Harry Carney around the corner on Cunard Street. Carney would go to the New England Conservatory and become the deep ballast of the Ellington Band on baritone saxophone. And he had an even longer career than Hodges did. There's a marvelous Alan Crite painting, big painting of Hammond Street, a parade,
right.
Sunday. Everybody's dressed, everybody's snapping to.
Yeah.
It's energized, it's aspirational, it's fun.
It is the whole community. It's a small community. You gotta understand that most black people who left the South didn't come to Boston.
Right.
You know, and you know why they didn't come to Boston? Because believe it or not, Boston was a backwater. Boston was an economic backwater.
Wow.
in the first half of the 20th century, right? And so black people went generally to where there were jobs.
But even then, Boston was in the thick of identity arguments. There was Booker T. Washington's black self-sufficiency, W.E.B. Du Bois's agitation against Jim Crow segregation, there was Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa theme, and the local hero, Monroe Trotter, who published The Guardian for activists and lived on Harry Carney's Cunard Street.
And Booker T. Washington would come to Boston. Trotter would organize groups to go heckle him.
Wow.
Right. The most famous of those is at a church that's a few blocks away from here, still standing, Columbus Avenue, AMEZ Church, where Booker T. Washington spoke. And Trotter supposedly organized a group of people. He went there to heckle, but he organizes a group of people, and some of them put off smoke bombs in this lecture, and they get arrested. It's called the Boston Riot.
Wow.
Who's into this? Is the neighbor? This is what this 14-year-old is arriving in.
As Byron Rushing is recreating the 1920s on Warwick Street, a neighbor, Beverly, steps out of that old era and tells me her mother knew Johnny Hodges 100 years ago.
My mother, she knew Johnny Hodges.
So your mother knew the world he grew up in. What was it like?
I think it was a very close neighborhood. This is the neighborhood also of Alan Crite.
Absolutely. I know his painting of the parade on Hammond Street.
And so he was around. Lots of folks were around at that time during those years. I do think that there was a kind of mirroring the New York situation with the Renaissance.
The Harlem Renaissance.
With Byron here, I will say, these people were either actually connected or ideologically connected to Marcus Garvey.
Interesting.
Meaning that while we struggled, we knew something about our base and possibilities. And black leadership. And that was strong in those days here. I mean, it has continued to be strong, but there used to be a place on the Guardian, was that printed on out of Tremont Street? It was one of my father's hangouts.
But this was a big 20s thing, right? This, all of this creative out there stuff. You start here and get out of here.
Absolutely, but you're going places.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, but in order to go places, you have to leave.
Johnny Hodges' interviews were rarities, but YouTube turns up one of them, talking about his days growing up in Boston.
Oh, I started 10 or 12 years old. And my parents wanted me to learn how to play piano. And I didn't like piano. I wanted to play drums. So you have to beat up all the pots and pans, you know, in the kitchen, like that's it. But later on, I just liked the looks of the saxophone. So I wound up with soprano. And I had the soprano on, the curve sopranos in. And I heard so much about Sidney Bechet. And my sister knew him when he was playing in Boston at the burlesque house called Jimmy Cooper's Black and White Show. So I got up enough nerve, which I did at that particular time. I had a lot of nerve, so I went back to see him. I had my soprano on my arm, and I had cut off one of my mother's sleeves of her coat and put the soprano in it. So, he said, "What's that?" I said, "That's saxophone." He said, "Can you play it?" I said, "Yes." I only had it about 2 days. I said, "Yes." And I never expected that I'd wind up playing with him 2-3 years later. And then something like 1925, I went to New York just for a visit, you know. So I would come to New York and get educated, right? You know, I'd go into jam sessions. They didn't call them jam sessions at the time. They called them cutting contests. And you'd walk up 7th Avenue and a person would hang your card, say, jam session, cutting contest, rather. Duke Ellington was one of the judges, and Fats Waller, and Fletcher Henderson, James B. Johnson, Willard Lyon Smith. So it was a big honor to get cut. They call them cutting contests. If you got cut, then you were real known, see? But it was educational. So I would get all these ideas and go back to Boston.
The best Boston story about Johnny Hodges came years later, told in Malcolm X's autobiography. In 1940, Malcolm was a starstruck hustler, not yet a revolutionist. He had a shoeshine stand in Boston's Roseland Ballroom where the big bands played for dancers. Suddenly one night, there was his idol, Johnny Hodges, in his chair, and Malcolm went about making his shine rags sound like Chinese firecrackers, he said. But Hodges got distracted and walked out without paying. Malcolm was scalded, ready to give chase, until he thought, how could I bother the great Hodges, who did what he did with Daydream for 15 cents? Johnny Hodges, by the 1940s, had become the year-after-year poll winner, the uncontested number one alto sax player in jazz. Ever after in the Ellington Band, Hodges and his friend Harry Carney played the high and low notes in the tight arrangements of five or more reed and brass instruments. You can hear them both in the weave of voices here in Duke Ellington's tribute to the sweet New Year's Eve sound of Guy Lombardo's dance band. Outside the Ellington Band, there came to be many varieties of Johnny Hodges. Lawrence Welk, the TV accordionist and band leader, with the middlebrow champagne sound and the bubble machine on set, adored Hodges and would gladly have hired him full-time. Hodges acknowledged that he had never played Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust in his life before he met Welk. But with the help of Hollywood's top arrangers, he made the most of it. He's a great artist, the bandleader said of Hodges, and besides everything else, he plays the prettiest saxophone of anyone I know. But Hodges and jazz were not to be separated, and he was not about to give up the edgy blues sensibility that protected his lush sound from sentimentality. Three examples here in very different pairings. On the Atlantic City boardwalk, and then in a handful of popular records, Johnny Hodges and Wild Bill Davis at the Hammond Organ set a trend in organ saxophone duos. This was Billy Strayhorn's tune, Drop Me Off in Harlem, shifting into double time. Guitarist Tiny Grimes, who had accompanied the legends Art Tatum and Billie Holiday, Hodges, the wordless conversationalist and storyteller, recorded this tiny bit of blues. And then the two masters and partners, Duke and Little Duke, as some bandsmen thought of Johnny, made their contribution to jazz chamber music with first back-to-back and then side-to-side albums, blues in more of that conversational spirit. Hodges had exiled himself from the Ellington Band in the early 50s to try his luck as a leader. By 1956, he was tired of it, and he returned to the fold just in time to help propel Ellington to his biggest record and the cover of Time magazine for a night of near riotous excitement at the Newport Jazz Festival. The saxophone soloist who lit the fuse that night was not Hodges, but the tenor man Paul Gonsalves from Brockton, Massachusetts, improvising through an unthinkable 27 choruses of Duke's forgotten diminuendo and crescendo in blue. It was Hodges' role to calm the crowd when the police saw chaos coming. Duke called on Hodges for his Jeep's Blues in what became the classic version. Thank you. Coming up, the jazz biographer Robin Kelly reminding us that Hodges set the stage for every alto player who came later, not least Charlie Parker. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The saying goes that the music you love at age 12 to 14 becomes the music of your life. The eminent jazz historian Robin D.G. Kelly, best known for his Life of Thelonious Monk, came to Johnny Hodges a lot later, and he frames our man in a bigger picture.
Let me tell a story about how I came to Johnny Hodges, because, you know, I'm of the generation where, you know, my saxophone players were John Coltrane, you know, Sonny Rollins. And, you know, I wasn't listening to Duke Ellington, you know, as a young person coming up. I mean, Duke was important, historical, but it was Coltrane who identified Johnny Hodges as his, you know, most influential figure coming up. You know, of course, Coltrane started out on alto saxophone, and it's through my study of Coltrane that I discovered Johnny Hodges and discovered that tone of his famous glissando, you know, that clarity of tone. And you have to understand that, you know, for so many people of the 20th century, it's the tenor saxophone that carries the weight. And the alto saxophone is pegged to one person. And that's Bird. That's Charlie Parker. And, of course, there's Jackie McLean and others. But Charlie Parker was the alto saxophone of the mid-20th century. So for me to discover Johnny Hodges, what I discovered was Johnny Hodges was, before Bird, the alto saxophonist of the 20th century. I mean, he set the stage for every alto player who came after him, but also set the stage for a kind of lyricism that we associate with tenor players like Lester Young, and also a kind of a tone that we sometimes associate with a kind of virility of Coleman Hawkins. Mm. And in some ways, Johnny Hodges combined both of those things on alto. The other thing about Johnny Hodges is that when we think about the importance of Duke Ellington, the Ellington Orchestra, its various iterations from the Cotton Club days of the 1920s through the 1960s, you know, when they did a lot of soundtracks and large orchestral pieces and things like that, all the way through, you know, Black, Brown, and Beige in mid-20th century. I mean, you can't think of Ellington's band without Johnny Hodges' sound.
True.
You know, I mean, Ellington, and some of your listeners will identify with this, but, you know, Ellington's band was kind of like the Wu-Tang Clan, you know, in that you have all these, you know, amazing artists. Ghostface Killer and the M-E-T-H-O-D, man. Who see the band as both Ellington, but also as a collective. And they were all free to do basically what they want to do and come back into the fold. When, you know, Hodges took his solos, you know, Ellington as a pianist, same with Billy Strayhorn, but Ellington as a pianist in particular had a way of playing with his, I wouldn't call them sidemen, but the stars of the band, that wasn't about accompaniment as much as embellishment. You know, Ellington and Hodges would play together, you know, in conversation. You know, you'd hear that. And so in that sense, Johnny Hodges is a giant artistic figure of the 20th century. And when it comes to alto players, you know, he and Byrd, I mean, virtually stand alone. I mean, yes. I mean, my heroes are Ornette Coleman and Cannonball and others. But something about Johnny Hodges setting the stage for them all, I think, you know, needs to be noticed.
Beautifully said. And sticking with it, the legend was that Ben Webster went uptown to hear the new sounds coming out of Monroe's and, what am I thinking? What am
yeah,
I?
Yeah, Minton's.
And Minton's. And coming back and saying, this guy, Byrd, is going to change everything. And Hodges responding, he's not going to change me. In the Funky Blues piece, in that Hollywood, Parker, everybody, Oscar Peterson, Charlie Shavers, etc., Hodges, beginning, plays two choruses, and Parker, to my mind, comes in with such love for his
yes.
his papa, and then takes off in a totally different tempo and speed and range.
Right.
But it's a transition. It's nobody's getting crushed here. It's thank you, Dad.
Exactly. No, that is so true. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that recording that was recorded, I guess, June 17th, 1952. It's like Norman Grant's jam sessions.
Right.
And I love that recording because you hear these different generations. You know, you hear, as you mentioned, Charlie Shavers, you hear Johnny Hodges, Benny Carter.
Yes.
And Benny Carter and Johnny Hodges had some tension. That's another story. Charlie Parker, Ben Webster, Oscar Peterson on piano. And it's a blues. It's not a cutting session, though. It reveals two things for me. One, the limits of labels, the way we think about modern music or bebop versus swing, none of those labels fit. They're all making music and all making music in tribute to one another. Mm. And it's jazz. It's the whole, you know. And I think that's just lovely. And the other thing you hear is Johnny Hodges' tone goes so far. You know, he doesn't need to engage in pyrotechnics to make amazing music to get people to pay attention. Mm. You know, I teach Black, Brown, and Beige in my jazz politics course. And, you know, before Mahalia Jackson, there was Johnny Hodges in that 1943 performance at Carnegie Hall. And it's lovely how, you know, how much he sounds like the voice of a soul Black woman standing in a church or in a field. And you hear that sort of theme of Come Sunday, it's spectacular, you know, and it's quite lyrical. And I could hear how listening to Johnny Hodges would convince Duke to bring Mahalia Jackson on, you know.
Have I ever told you, I mean, my analogy for the Ellington Band is Wu-Tang is fascinating, but is Emerson and the Concord Group. I mean, all these, and Emerson is Duke, obviously, but Walt Whitman is in and out, Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Margaret Fuller, you name them. All these independent voices that felt comfortable in this circle, and it was right. Now it's time for you to solo, Walt Whitman. This very curious sort of band of voices,
mm-hmm.
all incredibly individual and yet somehow transcendentally connected.
Right. Well, Melville took the longest solos for sure. But those are some soulful people, I have to say, you know.
Robin Kelly marks another critical turn in the Ellington and Hodges stories. It was the afternoon in Pittsburgh at the end of 1938 when the local prodigy, Billy Strayhorn, in his early 20s, came backstage at the Stanley Theater and wowed Duke Ellington with his piano mastery. Strayhorn had already written the words and music of the soon-to-be classic tune, Lush Life, and he could already imitate Ellington's piano style uncannily. So Duke hired him on the spot as his co-composer and alter ego. Over the next 25 years, Strayhorn wrote songs for Hodges, songs that only Hodges could inhabit. Daydream, Chelsea Bridge, Isfahan, Star-Crossed Lovers, they're all songs in a European tradition.
And when Strayhorn came in the band, it changed everything. Hodges' whole approach shifted. His tone remained the same, but he became more inclined to play those beautiful ballads. And so in some ways, I would argue that Hodges became Strayhorn's voice.
On this Ellington Hodges duet, for example, with Billy Strayhorn's tune, Passion Flower. Art songs in American songs are not leader. They're out. They're in a different bag. But on the other hand, I think there are Billie Holiday songs, even mm-hmm. Sinatra songs, and certainly Strayhorn Hodges songs that become art songs.
Yeah, no question. It's all in the definition, you know, because I think American art songs are grounded in this music that we call jazz today.
Wondered if Johnny Hodges could have or should have left his happy nest inside the Ellington band. Question might be, could he have left the three-way partnership with Ellington and Strayhorn, which produced the best of Hodges' catalog? Isfahan from Ellington's Far East Suite was another example of Hodges giving voice as only he could to Strayhorn's ideas. Ultimate statement or song from Ellington, Strayhorn, and Hodges was a round of thanks and wonder and farewell, a sort of triple elegy called Blood Count. Strayhorn wrote the music on his hospital deathbed, maybe looking at his medical chart. The solo voice was for no one but Hodges. Ellington saw to the orchestration and inclusion of Blood Count on one of his most loved late albums titled, And His Mother Called Him Bill. And Hodges delivered his last exaltation of Strayhorn's sensibility. ¶¶ Among artistic geniuses from Boston in the 20th century, I put it once to Gunther Schuller, the man of all musics. Who would be remembered longer, his friend Leonard Bernstein or Johnny Hodges? The difference, Gunther said, was that Bernstein wrote both masterpieces, West Side Story, of course, and lesser stuff, but every note Johnny Hodges recorded was perfect, Gunther said. Thank you, Con Chapman, whose new book is called Rabbit's Blues, The Life and Music of Johnny Hodges. Thank you also to Robin Kelly and Byron Rushing. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer and mixmaster. Mary McGrath keeps our band on time. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time and every time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.